We're glad you're here this morning, hanging out with us and being a part of our worship today. We're dealing with a crazy story this morning. Just one of those like, woo, didn't expect this. Kind of came out of right field. And the reason it's hard is because we like our stories to resolve. You know, we go to movies. My guess is your favorite movie has this really cool story that resolves. And if it doesn't, you're going to leave a movie frustrated. For example, we want Remember the Titans. We want the team to win the final football game, right? And they overcome the problem with adversity and the racist and some of the other struggles. And while the school around them may be falling apart, the football team comes together. And because of that, they get to the end of the season, they win the final game. Or we want the guy to fall in love with the girl, and even though in most movies it's the guy who has all the problems, because we know that's true. And but the guy goes through these struggles and the relationship is battle, but in the end they end up together and they all live happily ever after, right? They ride off on the horse into the sunset. We know that the movie can end because their life is going to be wonderful from here on out. No problems. They've solved the problems in the movie. They can go on. We want Ebenezer Scrooge to have his epiphany, and after Ebenezer Scrooge has his epiphany, he now is a changed man and everything's right. And so what happens, this is the way we see stories. We like stories that resolve, where there is a hero of some sort, and the hero or the heroine somehow has this major struggle, this issue in life, but what happens is that issue is dealt with and the struggle's over. They now go on in their lives as the people that we want to admire, the people we want to look up to. And what happens is we come to the Bible expecting that to be the way the stories in the Bible work, right? And so we start reading the Bible, and we come to these people in the Bible, and we think that they are representative of some kind of hero. And yes, we see their flaws. Yes, we see their brokenness, but they're going to meet their God, right? And once they meet their God, everything's right with the world. They all live happily ever after. There's no problems after that. And then we start actually reading the Bible. Like, now, let me help you with this, okay? The reason we have this mindset is because, A, we like stories like this, and B, if you grew up in a church at all, you went to Sunday school where there were flannel graph and veggie tale stories. And you may have grown up in a home where there were children's Bibles. And what they did is they presented the story like that's the way it is. I mean, here's the bottom line. The story we're talking about today, the story of the golden calf in the book of Exodus, there probably is not a VeggieTales on this one. There's not a children's Sunday school where they're going to send our kids home with a coloring page of what really was going on here. Because this looks more like Mardi Gras than it does Sunday morning. And so what happens, we read the Bible and we kind of have this backdrop of really only being told the good stories with the good heroes who end well. And we don't get to the part of the story where every last person or group of people in the Bible keeps being confronted with this core problem in their lives, even if they are redeemed people. And so we think Exodus, right? We think this is what's going to happen in Exodus. If you've been with us, that they're slaves in Egypt, that God saw their misery and raised up a leader, that God acts on their behalf and sends 10 plagues to Egypt and delivers them from slavery. They come to the Red Sea and the Red Sea's parted, and they literally are delivered from slavery, and God wins this ultimate victory and he redeems them and rescues them from slavery. He brings them to this mountain, and the God of the universe begins to have a conversation, a relationship. Literally, the elders of Israel come up the mountain and meet and have a meal with their God. God forms a covenant relationship where he gives them commands, but more than the commands, he says, I will be your God and you will be my people. And then he says, I'm going to give you plans for how to worship. I'm going to give you the plans for this tent where you will come together and you will worship me and you will remember the sacrifice that is being made for your sin and forgiveness, but I will give you access into my presence. We see this beautiful picture of the priesthood and how God has organized and planned this one group of people who will represent him to their people, and they will have a relationship. The priest will then teach them the word and go to God on their behalf. And I mean, this is what you expect, right? You expect all this stuff laid out, that God gives explanation, and then it jumps right to sacrificial giving of God's people, and that they are faithful, and now God has changed their lives, and they all live happily ever after, right? And then you get to chapter 32, and it's all jacked up. It is just like, it totally throws a wrench in the story, it literally leaves this story so open-ended, you don't know what to do with it. I literally don't know what to do with it when the hero that the people I think are supposed to be God's redeemed people, who are now the model for us to follow, are so terrible. And you start reading the Bible, it's like every last one of them. You read Noah's story, and those of you who've hung around, you've heard me talk about this. You read Noah's story, right? You think Noah's the hero. He built a boat. We end up with a movie in the 21st century that helps us see how beautiful, because the boat lands on the Capitol and solves all the problems, right? He's the hero. And then I keep reading, and the end of the Noah story, Noah is drunk, naked, and passed out in his tent like a redneck in a NASCAR race. And then you read the David story, like, oh, here's our hero. David is this great king who God made a covenant. He's going to be this great king. And David ends up seeing a naked woman, getting turned on, sleeping with her, getting her pregnant, and eventually killing her husband. We have Moses, and we really dig deep in the Moses story, and we got to remember that Moses is a murderer who, later in the story, when we get into the book of Numbers, just basically stands up and says, we don't need God anymore, I can do all this myself, in front of the people, and strikes a rock that all of a sudden water has been coming out of the rock when Moses has been striking it, like he could do that. Like, you know, he's got this brilliant idea, I'm going to walk out and hit a rock with my staff and water's going to come. But now he kind of thumps his chest and flexes his muscles like he's the one who's making it happen. I mean, we keep reading, and there's this core issue in God's people that just doesn't quite seem to resolve. And the story never quite gets to that happily ever after where the people have everything figured out and the problems are no longer really problems and they can go on in the world without it really confronting them. And when we grow up reading the Bible that way, it all of a sudden throws us off. If you've been hanging out at Genesis for a while, you know that one of the things that I do is a side gig is I teach Old and New Testament history. And so when I start having students in my class who have grown up either religious or irreligious, but a lot of them have never read the Bible before, they have ideas about what the Bible should be like, they start reading the Bible and they start seeing who these miserable cusses are. And they're like, my family's better than these goofy people. And what happens is it's like, how do we make sense of this? Now, the only way to make sense of it is to understand that there's no hero in the Bible but Jesus. But there is something being told to us about who we are and our struggle. And that core issue, the Bible does call it sin. But I grew up having sin presented to me as if it was the wrong stuff I do. And that is a partial and truthful explanation of sin, but it's not complete. So I grew up in churches where the pastor would tell me, you know, you need to quit sinning, which in my mind meant I need to quit. Like, I shouldn't go to certain places, and I had to date the right kind of girls, and I had to avoid certain things. And man, as a Baptist, it meant I didn't go anywhere near anything that had alcohol in it, because that was like the ultimate sin. Like, you know, if you even smelled an Anheuser-Busch product, you were like, straight to hell, do not pass go, do not collect $200, right? You know, it's just kind of the mindset was, here's what it means to stop sinning. It wasn't until I was well into my adult years where I began to understand that the wrong things I do is just the symptom of a different problem that's bigger. I do wrong stuff, that's a symptom of the fact that I am at the heart a person who is an idolater. So what for some of you, this may be totally new this morning. For others, this may be a repeat. I want to talk to you about the core problem in our heart. Even as if you are a follower of Jesus this morning, or if you are a person who is still trying to figure this thing out and say, man, what is Christianity all about? I don't really know Jesus. I'm not sure I get this yet. No matter where we're at, this is the core problem of our heart. It's not the wrong stuff we do. It's the wrong thing that we are. And that there is a core issue inside of us that we love shiny things. And we are so drawn to them, and we end up replacing the one true God with stuff that just doesn't matter. We think it matters. We think our lives will work. We think everything will be wonderful if we had this thing. And that's what happens in Exodus. See, what's happened is in Exodus chapter 20, God gave the Ten Commandments, right? He said, here's kind of the rules that you're going to live by with me as your God. And those commandments have things like don't covet, don't commit adultery, don't steal. I mean, all this stuff that's, you know, we're like, yes. But the first two are kind of weird. We start with the first two commandments in Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 through 6. Do we have that, guys? God spoke all these words saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in earth beneath or that is in the water underneath the earth. And you shall not bow down to them or serve them, for the Lord your God, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children of third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now here's what God is saying, is God is laying out the Ten Commandments, these like the top 10 lists. I mean, David Letterman's got like 3 weeks left, right? He's been doing top 10 lists for 30-something years now. But the first one, God said, listen, as I explained to you how I want you to live on the earth, here's the top 10. And there's 10 commandments, but the first two are no other gods other than me and no idols. Don't make anything that is a tangible representation of anything spiritual that then becomes the object of your worship, and you displace your worship of me trying to go through an object that is not me. Don't craft anything that then say, this is my God. Now, what's going to happen here in just a minute, we're going to see that that's the very thing they do. They go, you know, Moses is gone. Make us a God so that we can fall down before that and worship it. But what happens is God gives the Ten Commandments. Actually, Martin Luther said this, that the first two commandments are the sum total of all the rest of the commandments in the Bible. Because the core problem is not the wrong stuff we do. The core problem is that over and over and over again, I turn from the true and living God to worship created things. And I begin to replace God in my life with something that doesn't have the value. In other words, I take the gift that God has given in creation, and instead of enjoying the gift and worshiping the giver, I make the gift ultimate. And I begin to give myself away to things that God has created and make them ultimate. And as I move towards that, I will displace God with something else that is shiny, that is close, that is tangible. And so what God's saying here is, listen, first of all, the first thing is no other gods. Do not forget there isn't anybody except me. And God gets to define himself. God says, I'm going to tell you who I am. You worship me in truth. And then don't start trying to craft something, because anytime we try to reduce God down to the tangible, we will both misrepresent him and we will reduce him down to something that he is not, that is not capable. And we will begin to create an avenue of worship of what we exalt. So here's what we do. Here's how this commandment's broken, because we're so sophisticated. We think, like, I'm sitting here talking about idolatry, and already some of you are thinking, listen, I've never sacrificed a chicken to a statue in my life. Now, we've sacrificed chicken to, well, Chick-fil-A, right? That's what that is. But never, like, I don't have a little gold statue or a cow in my house that I sacrifice a chicken and pour the blood. I mean, I don't do that. That's what we think of idolatry. We know that there's cultures around the world that still do this kind of stuff. I was listening to one guy who was preaching on this and said he was in India, and he was like walking around the streets in India, and he saw in India all these idols and all these shrines and all these places where they were sacrificing goats and chickens to statues of weird animals and other spiritual beings. And he got into a conversation with a lady who was there, and he started talking to this lady who lived in India and said, have you ever been to America? And she said, yes, I have, and I'm never going back. And he said, why aren't you going back? And she said, I can't stomach the idolatry. And he's like, lady, there's a shrine up the street that has a weird being and a statue that they're sacrificing chickens to. Idolatry, what do you mean? And she said, your God is your stomach. You have restaurants everywhere. She said, you worship your sports teams. And just like our people go to the shrine and they paint themselves and then they bow down and as a group, you go and as a group, you have on the same clothes. You have your worship clothes on. You paint your faces and you all lift your hands as if you were worshiping something. She said, I just walked around and you have idols in people everywhere. And she said, I can't stomach the idolatry. See, this is what happens with us, is that God says, listen, focus on me, value me, worship me, treasure me, find your joy in me. I am your source. I am the one who has everything for you. Don't leave me. I am your God. And what we do is we hear that, but then we think, but if I only had this, if my life was only like that, if I could only integrate this into my life, everything would be okay. And we begin to pursue anything, everything other than God. And then we say, here's our prayer. God bless this. And then we create avenues of worship of those things. We create shrines and begin to sacrifice and give ourselves away to the very things that maybe it's not a Buddha God, but it is something that we have now exalted as the thing that gives me hope, joy, that my life revolves around. And we make idols out of everything. I was having this conversation in my class one time just about what is more important to you than God is your idol. Because there's this heart issue, and you'll begin to create avenues of worship. The avenues of worship then are the other Ten Commandments. So for example, if you have a sex idol, you're going to commit adultery. Now, saying don't commit adultery says we don't want you to do that. That's not God's best for you. But at the core of the issue is not who you sleep with, it's who is your God. Because now sex becomes this thing that replaces the beauty of a relationship with God in your life, and it's ultimate for you. If you have a money God, you're going to start coveting and you're going to start stealing. You're going to start being dishonest with the way you do things. You're going to start bowing down to the God of the lottery or the horse race or whatever it is, believing that if you could just win the lottery or if you could just have this, my life would work. And so the other commandments are now telling us what it looks like when we are falling away from the first two. Don't commit adultery. It's all just starts with one God. Don't try to replace God with something tangible that's right here in front of you that can solve your problems, that's in your hands. And so as we wrestle with this, I was talking to this lady in my class or teaching this, and this one lady, I'll never forget it. She's sitting over on a side, you know, at her table, and I'm talking about idolatry out of the story of Exodus in my class, and I hear her go. And I'm like, what'd I do? She goes, my garden. What about your garden? I love my garden. It's the most important thing. I live for my garden. I want everybody in my world to know that I have the best garden in my neighborhood. I'm like, all right, that's awesome. You're going to bring me some vegetables? What's the point? She goes, you're telling me this is my idol. All right, never heard that one before, but there you go. All right, your garden. But she had come to the point where she realized that instead of celebrating the garden as a gift from God and that the joy goes to him, that she literally made the garden the source of her identity, the source of her joy, the source of her hope. We do this with our kids. Listen, kids are great gifts. Amen? Amen. Most of the time, kids are great gifts from God, right? Sometimes we're like, I'll give them back. Just, you know, the best offer, they're yours. But most of the time, we're like, kids are great gifts. Kids are terrible idols. But boy, we live like West County, Eureka. How many avenues of worship and shrines do we set up, are set up by parents who have made their kids the ultimate thing in their lives? They live vicariously through their kids, and they place a weight on the shoulders that the kids can't can't stand underneath. It's a weight they can't bear. And when kids are gifts and God is our source, kids are great things. Fallen kids, but they're great things. They're a gift from God. But when kids become the center of everything, kids make lousy gods. Lousy gods. And then what happens with our idolatry? This is all just setting up where the story goes. What happens with our idolatry is that God will either do one of two things. When you want your idols, when you live for something and you make it ultimate in your life and you pursue it with everything that you are, God will either give you your idols or he won't. And either way, if he gives you your idols will ultimately destroy you and you will be enslaved by them. And if you won't, you'll become bitter towards God because he won't serve your idols and they will ultimately destroy you and you'll become bitter towards God. See that? Either way, you get them or you don't, the outcome of you pursuing idolatry in the place of God is you will look despise God and become bitter towards him. And so what happens, we start reading the Bible, and the Bible's just like real. Instead of trying to be this cute little story that has a resolution, it's just being real and saying, this is the way it really works. You give your life to Jesus, you trust Christ, he redeems, you still have this problem in your heart that is ongoing, and you must be aware of it. And when you do fall and begin to create a golden statue to the God that you have made in your mind, you have to come back and repent and turn from it. And so these are God's, this is important in the story. This is not a bunch of pagan people who don't know the one true God. This is a story of God's redeemed and rescued people who fail miserably. So grab a Bible, Exodus chapter 32 through chapter 34. We're going to read little bits and pieces of the story and just kind of interact with what happens. And then we're going to talk about, in the end, three different things that come out of the story about how we interact and deal with the issue of idolatry, of sinfulness, of brokenness in the world. Exodus chapter 32. And let's start with verses 1 to 14 that just kind of lay the groundwork for us. It says, "When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, 'Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.' So Aaron said to them, 'Take off the rings of gold that are in your ears of your wives, your sons and your daughters, and bring them to me.' So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in the ears of in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from the hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, 'These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, 'Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord.' And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought a peace offering. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." Now, let's just get real honest and say what's going on here, okay? The people who just heard one God, no idols, have Moses on the mountain for 40 days. So their key leader has left them and he is conversing with God, getting the Ten Commandments on tablets that God is writing with his own finger. So here's what's going on. There is a mountain. They're at the base of the mountain. Up on the mountain, God with his own finger is now writing in tablets of stone the words we just read that says, "One God, no idols." Meanwhile, the people who've already heard this are down in the valley breaking those and every other one of the Ten Commandments. Like, it's a free-for-all. It's a crazy event. So they come to Aaron, who's Moses' brother, who's the first high priest, and says, "We don't know where Moses has gone. We're tired of being here at the mountain. We're ready to get on with our lives. We don't know if he's ever coming back. So will you make us a God who can go before us, who can make, you know, lead us out into the wilderness and get us to this promised land that we're supposed to get? We need to get there. We're done here. And so make us," and Aaron, you know, this great spiritual leader, goes, "Bring me all your gold earrings. We'll make something." And it says he fashions a golden calf. I just love that, you know, that when it's like almost silly. You're like, "All right, we're going to bow down to something. A cow." It's amazing how in all these cultures, cow becomes like this object of worship. I mean, have you ever been around cows? Not once have I ever been around cows going, "Oh my God, oh my God." I look at them and go, "These are the dumbest animals in the world. But they're really tasty." You know, and so it's amazing. But see, this actually is a return to the spirituality of Egypt. Egypt had all these deities that used bulls and cows and all this to represent the deities that they worshiped. And so they are literally returning back to Egypt in their spirituality. They're just pulling the Egyptian deities and saying, "Let's make a new god." And Aaron goes, "Okay." And so he fashions this really cool looking all gold, probably formed it out of wood first, and the gold-plated golden calf. And he says, "Here's what we're going to do. We are going to come, and we're going to celebrate a festival. We're going to have a party. We're going to bow down and worship. We're going to offer sacrifices to our God. Here is the God who brought us out of Egypt." And it says that they came, and they celebrated a festival. They ate, and they drank, and they began to play. Okay? Which means what we end up here is with a pagan ritual festival that looks a lot more like Daytona Beach on spring break than it does Sunday morning in a church. I mean, I don't want to like get real graphic with you, okay, because I know there's some kids and I don't want to freak everybody out, but the bottom line is, this is not a PG-13 part of the movie. If we were to make this a really show, it would be rated R and really bad R. This is a crazy sex fest that has turned into this just all out, just total abandonment of anything that God had told them. Like everything is just out the window, and they have lost their minds as they begin to give themselves in worship. It's amazing. It really is amazing how the Bible just helps us with something right here. How the culture is always going to run to sex as an avenue of worship and freedom of sex as a given right. You can pretty much know that when people are starting to abandon God, they're going to start saying that God's ways of dealing with our sexuality is antiquated. It's just, and it's not, this is not a new thing. You think, oh, we're 21st century. We've come a long way, baby. It's a different generation. God, listen, people are no different. The sexuality of the Roman Empire is way more free and open in all aspects than America right now. We're headed there, but the Roman Empire, where the New Testament was written, was a much more free love society than we are right now. So to say, well, the Bible just doesn't understand, these are people who just aren't thinking through this. And every culture, as they abandon, the cultures around Israel, as they move into the land, the culture of Egypt, every culture, part of their worship is to set up shrines that is cult prostitution, where in the worship of their deities, they are giving themselves, now it's always the dudes, right? There's like no place for the ladies to go to experience this. But almost every culture has a way for married men to leave their wives and go have relationship with somebody in the name of worship of their God so they can get a little on the side in the name of worship. It's crazy, right? Now, we're sophisticated. We don't have those places. Really? Just hop on a highway and go to Eastside. There's a bunch of clubs right over there that are the same thing. And so what happens is that as we struggle with this, as this idolatry comes in, they just lose everything. You start with, I'm going to, redefine God. We go from there to just an object of our worship that is tangible. It always ends here. It always is going to end here in some way, shape, or form as we give ourselves to the object of our worship. And so it's just crazy. Now, what happens in the story is that Moses is now on the mountain. And as he's up on the mountain, God begins to go, hey, Moses, you might want to go down and talk to your people because they've lost it, dude. And so here's what happens. Chapter 32, it says, verse 7, and the Lord said to Moses, go down for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, and they have corrupted themselves. Now, notice, I love this. At this point, God's like, all right, the people, listen, you brought these people up. I don't even want to put my name with these people right now. Go down and talk to these people. They've corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them, and they have made themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them in order that I may make a great nation of you. In other words, God says, so here's the deal, Moses, just get out of my way. I'm going to wipe them out and start over with you. I will make a great nation from you. Now, that sounds weird, and we look at this, and it becomes very tough for us to interact with a God who says this and then doesn't do it. What's going on here? We're going to talk about that in just a minute. But Moses implored the Lord, his God, and said, O Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt and with great power and with a mighty hand? In other words, why are you mad at the people you redeemed? You rescued these people. They're your people. You redeemed them. You rescued. Now, Moses is having a conversation with God. Later it tells us that God and Moses talked as if they were best friends. I love that. That's prayer, just so you know. That's why May is prayer month. We need to get back to making sure we're having a conversation with God as if we're friends, because we are. And so God and Moses are talking, and Moses is saying, listen, you redeemed these people. You rescued them. You brought them out of Egypt. Why should the Egyptians say, with evil intent did he bring them out to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and relent from this disaster against your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by yourself and said to them, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and all the land that I have promised I will give to your offspring, and they shall inherit it forever. And the Lord relented from this disaster that he had spoken of bringing up on his people. In other words, here's God saying, listen, get out of my way, I'm going to wipe them out. And Moses goes, whoa, 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 let's talk. Listen, these are your people. You rescued them. If you wipe them out now, the world will look at you and go, this is the type of God you are, because the people you saved, now you've just wiped them out. And oh, by the way, you made a promise to their forefathers that you were going to give them the land. This is Moses' prayer, conversation with God, and it says God relented. Very interesting passage. What's going on? And what God's doing is he's telling us this big story. He's showing us how his grace really functions. God tells Moses what he should do to the people. And then he invites Moses to plead with him not to. And then God, because of the prayer of Moses, does not give them what they deserve. He gives them something different. What we learn here is this crazy interplay with prayer and God's sovereignty and his purpose. And so here's what happens in the story. Chapter 33, God tells the people, he says, listen, you just need to get out of here. You need to go, but I'm not going with you. And both Moses and the people beg of God, saying, we can't go anywhere without your presence. Then Moses had come down off the mountain, saw what was going on, and his heart is angered and broken at the sinful rebellion and idolatry of the people. It is a proper response. We cannot get comfortable. We should love people who are broken. We should never get to the point where the sinful rebellion of both people in the church and out of church, that we come to the point where we're just okay with it. There's a way to be angry like Jesus is at the brokenness in the world without treating people with anger. Does that make sense? But we should never get to the point where the willful rebellion of a world around us and of our lost friends and of people far from the gospel becomes something that we're just okay with. And so he comes down, and in anger, there's some things that happen, including the calling of these leaders, the Levites. And he actually tells them, anybody who hasn't repented, take their life. That's hard. It's an Old Testament response. There's no New Testament command for us to do this. We're not anywhere near that. But the heart of it, to say, listen, among God's people, when God's people are in full rebellion and have no desire to return, it should affect us. And so then what happens is that Moses begins to cry out to God, and there's this great prayer in Exodus chapter 33 where Moses again intercedes for the people, talking to God as if he was his friend and communicating with God about God's grace, about God's goodness, about what God should do to them, but what he will do to them, because he's a God who keeps his promises. And the outcomes that God gives us, gives his people in the Old Testament who have just lost their mind, the beauty of grace. Restoration, reconciliation. And so just a couple things real quick about what this teaches us about how we interact with our own idolatry. Okay? And so what we're going to talk about real quick is we're going to talk about the way down, the way out, and the way up. The way down, the way out, the way up. This idolatry issue. Let's talk first of all about the way down. What happens with these people is that they see Moses is gone, and their desires, their heart, they do not feel like their God is being what they expect him to be. And so they begin to move towards God, expecting something different and calling out to him. And all of a sudden, this idea of idolatry, I mean, we look and we're like, they are so close to this. How can they, the people who crossed the Red Sea, act like this? But the truth is, we are so much like them. So why is idolatry so, like, why does it pull our hearts so strongly? Well, I think it pulls our hearts because it's alluring. In other words, we really like the idea of senses being used to define God at any time. So it's alluring. And so what happens is we look at things in our world, and all of a sudden we end up with all these ideas of idols. For example, one of the things I want you to do is wrestle with where it is your idolatry. And our culture has all kinds of them. I've actually got some pictures to think through this morning. And I'm throwing my guys for a loop because I'm way out of this. There's one. Does that look like a group of people who are bowing down to something that they are? Those of you who are not University of Georgia fans are like, yeah. Those of you University of Georgia fans are like, nothing wrong with that. But see what happens. I mean, it's just a picture of this. And listen, I'm a sports fan, so I'm in with this. All right, how about this? There is our shrine. This is our place of worship for some of our idolatry, right? We have built huge, multi-million dollar places of worship where we all gather and we sacrifice to the gods that we have. They're called malls. We build them big. And if a mall's not big enough now, it doesn't survive because there's a bigger, better mall with a lot more stores. All right, how about this? What amazes me about this one, I mean, first of all, let's be honest, okay? We believe that our shiny little device will give us everything we need. We stare at it for hours. We bow down to it. We must have it with us. If we don't have our shiny little device, we get lost. And what cracks me up about Apple, personally, now I'm not an Apple guy, so some of y'all get offended, but they don't even hide it. Like, their logo is Genesis 3. Have you not caught this? I mean, their logo is, you know, bite the apple. Get it? I mean, listen, it's there. They're like, all right, Genesis 1, we're right with God. Genesis 2, Genesis 3, they ate the fruit. They took a bite, all was fallen. They're like, we get it. This is who we are. We're okay with that in the world. Come and worship. And, I mean, so they produce anything new, and everybody's like, I must have. If I don't have this, my life does not work. People, you know, wait in line for days to get the new iPhone or the new iPad. Now, listen, don't kid yourself. Those of us who are Android people or Windows people, we act the same way towards our stuff. I mean, we will bow down and get, we feel like our lives don't work if we don't have the newest item, the newest device, if we don't have it in our hands, all this sort of stuff. How about this? People. I don't know why the Apple thing stayed in there, but people. I mean, we have idols, right? I mean, all of a sudden we exalt people to this place of ultimate. And then we even have a show that lets us know about this. Right? Just in case we forgot, let's have a show that's called American Idol because we're going to worship these people if they win. Now, point is that this is the beckoning call. And so what happens in the story, these people do four things really fast. They don't do it really fast. Four things happen to them. They seek what the idol offers. Verse 1 says that they go and they said, listen, we're not getting out of God and out of Moses what we want, so make us a God who will do this for us. And instead of God being their supreme who dictates their life, they're like, we need a God that we can manipulate. And so they seek what the idol offers. They begin to sacrifice to the idol. Verse 2, they take all their gold and they begin to give it away. And they now are sacrificing something to the idol as they give themselves to it. They move from sacrificing to the idol to surrendering to the idol. As the story goes, what they end up doing is they end up literally coming to this golden calf and they begin to bow down and worship and they begin to give themselves to this idol as their hope, as their leader, as their dreams. And at the end, they actually then completely submit to the idol. Now they completely give themselves away and everything about who they are is given to the worship. And they just lose their minds. And what happens is we read the story, the question that all the commentators ask is, what do you have here? Do you have them worshiping Yahweh, their God, but trying to create an object, or do they have other gods? I think the reason there's debate is because the people are reverting back to Egypt, and Aaron is trying to accommodate that while keeping them with Yahweh. So one way of doing this is just to abandon God altogether and to abandon the one true God and to make our own gods. But the other way to do idolatry is to syncretize. In other words, what we're going to do is we're going to try to keep Jesus as our homeboy, Jesus as our hero, but we're just going to embrace all kinds of spiritual practices and ideas and all kinds of approaches so that at the end, Jesus will serve my idols. And I'll reshape Jesus to fit what I want him to be. And both happen in the story. And so as we do this, our idols begin to consume us, they begin to control us, we begin to give ourselves away, we begin to sacrifice and worship and give ourselves away. And this is the path that always goes. The idols are shiny and they make us feel like all will work. It's tangible. It's right here in our fingertips. It's right there. I mean, it's something we can hold, we can touch. That means we can also control it. So we can get the idol to do what we want it to do. I mean, a lot of people, millions around America, who, last night lost their minds because their cable went out and they'd paid for the Pacquiao Mayweather fight, right? I don't know if you heard this, but Charter and a whole bunch of other, if you went home last night and your cable didn't work, it's because they crashed trying to, so many people watching the fight, but they'd paid all this money for the fight. And boy, you read Twitter this morning, they were not happy. As they had given themselves, I mean, and all of a sudden their whole identity is wrapped up in this. We just tend this way. Now, you're like, all right, man, you pretty much told me I can't do anything in my life anymore. I can't have kids. I can't watch TV. I can't go to sport. No, you got to understand the issue of idolatry. God gives great gifts. We must always remember to celebrate the giver and not replace the giver with his gifts. Which means if he says, give the gift away, I give it away. If I find myself starting to drift towards the gift and making it ultimate, to know what that looks like. And so what happens in the story, it's really weird, and this leads us to the second point here, is the way out, is how the idol is dealt with. There are two big events in the story that are weird, okay? The first thing is that when Moses comes down from the mountain, go read this, and as you read the rest of the story this week, I really hope you're doing that with us. Moses comes down and he takes the idol, he burns it, he grinds it up, and he throws it into the water. In other words, we have ground beef. Okay, come on, that was funny. He grinds it and he throws it in the water, and then it is their water supply, they have to drink it. I always thought this was so weird. Like, now they're drinking water that's burnt gold and wood, and it's not really Kool-Aid anymore for sure. What is going on here? I read a couple commentaries this week, and they said something. I was like, oh, that's good. But consistent. This is what they said. You take it in, you got to poop it out. Right? And what Moses is showing the people is the real value of what they had worshipped. Because what they had taken in, they had to poop out. Now, there's your God. It's a steaming pile in the grass. You got to leave the camp. Actually, there's a law that says they have to leave the camp to do that. There's your God. And see, one of the things that the gospel helps us do is it begins to see the real vanity and worthlessness of our idols. As we begin to really look at our lives and say, man, what really is our life centered on? The gospel begins to show us the real vanity of worthlessness. This is why, like in the New Testament, Paul says, whatever things were gained to me, these things I count them as loss, and I count them, he says, I count them but rubbish in order that I may gain Christ. And in Philippians, where the English translator translate the word rubbish, here's what Paul is actually saying. That the original word means pile of poop. In other words, literally, what Paul is saying is all my accomplishments, all my awards, all the stuff that I had in my life, compared to knowing Christ, is just a steaming pile. The worthlessness of our idols. We have to be exposed to that. But telling us that our idols are worthless doesn't work, because we hear this in our culture and we say it will for me. For example, if I were to tell you that studies on people who won the lottery have really discovered that the most unhappy people in the world are people who have won the lottery, we hear that and we say, but that wouldn't happen to me. If I won, I'd be content. I'd be happy. Because we don't believe that our idols will do to us what it does to everybody else. We say, man, we look at all the celebrities that end up on the tabloids who none of them are happy. We say, but man, if I got there, if I could win American Idol, I would make it work. Because we don't believe that our idols will affect us the way it really does everybody else. And the gospel shows us the worthlessness. But then Moses in his prayer has this interesting thing. He says, show me your glory. He's praying to God and he says, show me your glory. And what happens is that God says, all right, here's what I'm going to do. If I let you see me face to face, it will kill you. But I'm going to let you experience seeing my presence. He says, I'm going to let you see my backside as I just kind of pass by and I kind of hide you. And Moses sees the very presence of the glory of God. And what he comes down off the mountain, and the people are looking at Moses, and literally his face is glowing as they are seeing the glory of God through the face of Moses, who has been with God. And now they are drawn to the glory of God because they see it in the face of Moses, who saw God face to face. It's a weird story. How does it fit in here? And this is the point. This is the point that's being made in this story, as we understand the gospel in our lives. We cannot just be told. We cannot just be told that our shiny idols are dangerous. We have to be given something that is better than the idols and turn to that. In other words, we have to the only way to overcome the idols in our life is to see something that is better than the idols and run to that. And so what happens, Jesus shows up in the story and he gives his life. And what we see is that Jesus, in the face of Jesus, we see the full glory of God who sheds his blood and dies on the cross for us, right? The only way to expel, to get rid of your idols in repentance is, yes, to realize that they're just a pile of steam and nothing. But it's also to have those idols replaced with someone who is better. To look to Christ and begin to see the glory of God in the face of Jesus. And to see that glory on display in your life. It's crazy how many New Testament passages refer back to this and show us how Jesus was the glory of God in coming. And that he fills us with that same glory through the presence of the Holy Spirit in our lives. Listen, Christ is better than any idol. I have to be reminded of this week. Because I am just like these people. And so the second thing, the way out is to realize that the gospel shows me the glory of God and to keep my eyes fixed on Jesus, who's the author and perfecter of my faith, and to let the glory of Christ shine in my life and to keep every day realizing that Jesus is better. Jesus is better than the idol of money. Jesus is better than the idol of sex. Jesus is better than the idol of, whatever it is. I need to be self-aware. And one of the challenges I will have you as you leave here today and think through this week is, what are the things in your life that are shiny that pull you, that you tend to exalt and become objects of your worship? But as you begin to wrestle with that, the way to overcome that is to realize that Jesus is better. So the third thing is the way up. And that is Moses as our model. And I would love to unpack this for a long time this morning, but the bottom line is the beauty of intercessory prayer is just laid out here. Because what you have is Moses then becomes the picture of God's people doing what they should do in a world that is full of idols. We should be bothered by it. And we should confront the brokenness in the church and among God's people with that. But the true thing that Moses does at least three times in a story is he runs to God and he has a conversation. And he cries out to God, begins to beg God to do other than what he does. And there's this crazy thing. Like, you'll hear people say, oh, prayer changes things. Then you hear other people say, oh, no, God is sovereign. God doesn't, change. That people change. So when you pray, prayer changes you. But God is sovereign. He's already determined everything that's going to happen. And what happens? You read the Bible and there's a God who is unchangeable, who has fixed everything, that he has sovereignly declared everything that is going to happen. And that God comes to Moses and says, this is what I'm planning on doing. And Moses goes, you can't. You are a God who, this is your character, and your purpose in the world is to display your glory. You made promises to these people, and all of a sudden the God who doesn't change changes his mind. And I don't get that, okay? I don't understand this, but this is what I do know, that the God who has ordained everything that will happen has ordained that we should pray. And when we pray, God does not respond to people as they deserve. God gives grace instead. And so we should pray. We should be a people who are crying out to God, who are begging God, my neighbors, they are far from you. Their lives are full of idols. please, for the glory of your name, the good of your people, give them something different. We should be praying for people in our neighborhoods. We should be praying for our president and our governmental leaders. We should be praying for our nation. Our tendency is when we see the sin in the world around us to ignore our own sin and go to war. And instead of doing that, we should fall on our knees and cry out to a God who will pour himself out on a people if his people would just pray. And so Moses gives this amazing model of a praying people. And I love this church. I'm telling you, I had so much fun yesterday. I love this church. But I can tell you after being here almost over 9 years that if we call you to a picnic and we call you to something fun, we will come out of the woodwork. But we ask our people to pray and nobody shows up. I love you. And if you're a guest, it's not like I'm not getting after you. I am getting after me a little bit. Because you look just like me. That's the problem. I'm slow to my knees. But if we really understand what's being taught in this passage, the idolatry of the people of God, the brokenness in the world, Moses' response is not to run around like a chicken with his head cut off wondering what to do. Moses is face to face with God going, "You are a good God. Give them grace." And here's what's crazy. God hears Moses' prayer, and rather than giving the people what they should have gotten, he gives them grace. Because there was an intercessor who would stand in the gap. Oh, that we would be those people. Oh, that we would be those people. As we see the glory of Christ and are drawn to him and understand that there is a Savior who poured his blood for the idolatry in the world. Will you? May's prayer month. Will you grab a book and help us pray? Will you get with your family and use the book and just pray with your family maybe or with your spouse? We have a prayer breakfast this Saturday. I mean, this Saturday. I guarantee you if we were offering something shiny, we'd show up. I really hope that we have too many people for our office on Saturday and we have to say, this is great. We need to go find someplace outside to do this because we can't fit in here, but it's never happened. It's never happened here. Will you join us Saturday as we come together and cry out to our God on behalf of our community and our culture? And I know life's busy. I got something. I will have to leave early. But, you know, prioritize prayer with us somewhere. I will be there, by the way. I just got to leave a few minutes early. Got to go coach a 6-year-old softball game, which maybe is my idol. I don't know. Will you maybe find one or two other people that are part of your church and say, hey, at least once a week this month, let's get together and let's just pray for our city and for the brokenness in the world. The beauty of the story is that Moses is the one who stood in the gap. Will you help us be that people this month? Now, we do 1 month because really every month ought to be prayer month, but we need to come back 1 month a year. So May is prayer month. Will you join us with that? And as you do that, will you spend the next few minutes just lifting up your own heart and the needs of God's people as we celebrate communion together? Our band's going to come up here on stage. We're going to sing and celebrate to Jesus. We're going to lift him up and worship our God, our King. And as you're here, we're going to start singing here in just a minute. Will you start just inventorying your own life and just saying, man, where are my idols? Where is it that my heart tends to drift? Begin to ask God to make ground beef out of your idols, to see them for what they really are, and to begin to show you his glory as we come to the table where his glory is on display, as we get to taste and feel the beauty of the sacrifice that was made as God gave his son to both forgive our idolatry, but also to crush it and to give us victory. Just in the next moment, we're here in a holy moment. God is in our midst. Christ is here. Will you lift your heart to him and experience him? If you're a follower of Jesus, celebrate communion with us. If you're not, maybe this is the moment, the time, the day where you literally come to Christ and just say, Jesus, I trust you. I'm giving myself to you. But just begin right now lifting your prayers to God and interceding for your family, for your city, for your church, for yourself. Lord, we love you and thank you for the fact that you are a God who allows us to come to you, allows us to know you, allows us to experience you. And I just pray that this moment in the next few minutes as we sing and celebrate and worship and we enjoy your table, that we will find that you are better. In your name I pray. Amen.